These are the Target Files. Journey back with us between the 1970s and 1990s on a TARDIS nostalgia trip as we look back at the novelizations and audiobook releases of classic Doctor Who stories. Gallifreyan Archive accessed. Subject: Time Lord known as the Doctor. Fifth incarnation. Adventure title: Earth Sol 3. Year of publication: 1982. Author: Ian Marter. A group of paleontologists have been savagely attacked while carrying out a study of a fossilized cave system on 25th century Earth. A party of troopers and Professor Kyle, the only survivor of the attack, are investigating the death of her colleagues when they discover the fifth Doctor and his companions at the site of the massacre. The time travelers are immediately suspected. In trying to establish their innocence and find out who or what was responsible for the killings, the Doctor is confronted by an old enemy. Hello, welcome to Doctor Who Target Files. This edition, we are discussing Earthshock, the fifth Doctor story, novelised by Ian Marter, along with the BBC audiobook release, read by Peter Davison, with voices of the Cybermen provided by Nicholas Briggs. Hi, this is Mike in Swansea.
And hi, this is Alex Nexeter.
Alex, your thoughts on this, quite sort of controversial at the time, due to its finale. We won't go spoiling that for everybody, but I'm sure a lot of our listeners are aware of the ending of the story and something very dramatic that happens. But your overall thoughts on this book and audiobook?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It had quite a good pace to it. It started off quite slow and individual sort of archaeology thing that the Doc gets involved with, and then quite fast moves on to like a sea incident, and then the really momentous thing at the end of this book, which, you know, probably people know about, is at the time caused quite a lot of controversy. Well, I really enjoyed it, actually.
Yes, we're going to wonder how we'll go about this for new listeners. I think we should give them a spoiler warning, really, because it's unavoidable that we are going to speak about what happens, aren't we? So I think, should we make a decision to say spoiler quite forcefully, Al, whenever we're going to...
Spoiler, definitely, because you can't really mention this book without spoiler alert that, you know, Adric dies, and it's all sort of set around that, really.
Yes, indeed. Sorry, what was that? Who does what? Sorry, you didn't say spoiler.
I did. I just spoiled it before.
My initial notes, Al, I've come up with, it's a gloomy, a graphically written, but very compelling story. I'd actually say it's Doctor Who at its very best. You know, that's probably going to give you an idea of my score towards the end. Would you agree with that, Al?
I would indeed, because it starts off with quite a sort of, you know, archaeologists dying for some quite dark reason, and then gets darker as it goes along, you know, you get that seed, and it feels like the Doctor's completely not in control for the whole of the book, basically, I feel.
Very fast-paced for classic Doctor Who, really, isn't it?
Oh, it's immensely fast-paced, you know, it sort of does have a really good pace, you know, you have slightly slowness at the beginning when the Doctor gets there, and then from the minute, you know, the surf and monsters turn up, you know, it sort of goes very fast-paced, and then you have the stuff on the spaceship, you have the sort of treachery, and we have the sort of great ending, you know, with something major happens. I quite liked how that sort of major event sort of built up throughout the book, the way that, you know, Adric's personality. Starts off as the sulky sort of child and turns into the hero by the end.
Yeah, immensely likeable towards the very end, and his ultimate fate. From, as you said, a slightly whiny character to begin with. Can I just talk a little about Ian Martyr? I think he's got a bit of a tradition going on with his books by this point, isn't he? In that he adds a lot of viscerality to the scenes. He manages to expand them. In particular, early on, I thought the scenes in the caves were really well elaborated upon in terms of what you see on a very sort of smaller set on TV. You get a great deal of tension in his writing, don't you? And just how serious a situation the TARDIS crew and the archaeologists they meet up with are in.
Oh, most definitely, I agree, because, you know, that set on the beginning of this, you know, Earthshot, the TV episode, isn't that great, to be honest. And in the book, it's really grubby and dirty and dark. Really makes you feel, you know, like cave-dwelling into it. That's that sort of pace throughout the book, where, you know, these are sort of not bright spaceships. These are people making merchandise and tracking across the space lanes. You know, that main ship of the Cybermen take over is a working ship.
Yeah, it puts me in mind of what started with the original Star Wars, really, the idea of a future in which things are reused as they are on Earth. You know, it's a very gritty look at it. You know, it was taken on by George Lucas in the original Star Wars and then sort of elaborated upon in the likes of Alien, wasn't it? You know, we see that really sort of run-down look about spaceships and the conditions that people live in.
Definitely, and I think that's been done throughout sci-fi over the years, because that's the theory, that we will reuse, you know, we'll run out of things, so we'll just keep reusing them. And I think it has that very sort of gritty, sort of maybe slight cyberpunk feel between us being reused and grittiness, and, you know, that, you know, we're running out of things, and the whole issue about gold and oil is definitely there, I think.
Yeah, in particular in terms of the spoiler, it's got the Cybermen in, folks, that's the spoiler. But something Ian Martyr does really well, he tries to evoke the fabulous cliffhanger you get at the end of part one in the TV story by not actually referring to the villains as their usual name of Cybermen until around about 50 pages in. Did you feel that worked out?
I thought that really worked, because you had this sort of, you know, bits where you're going back and forth to the Cybermen, and we've been excited in the audiobooks, you know it's them, but in no way is it mentioned that it's them. I think that ramps up the tension the whole way through the first couple of chapters till you find out later that it is them.
Sorry, character-wise, Al, I was very impressed, we've mentioned it before, with the strength of female characters in this book. We have the ship's captain, Bates, is it? Bates, her name? Briggs.
Briggs.
It is Briggs, like good old Nick Briggs, who's involved in the audiobook. Famously played on television, Briggs, by Beryl Reid. How do you feel she was written in the book? A very strong, forceful female character?
Yeah, I think she comes over very well. You know, she's forceful, she's a strong captain who's trying to keep her sort of ship alive right to the end of the book. You know, I was thinking about it earlier that there are some really good, strong characters in this. And then there's some that aren't as strong. You know, I think we have problems with Nyssa in this book, to be honest.
Yeah, it's very much a backstage character in this book.
Most definitely. I think, you know, you've got really strong female characters like Briggs and Tegan, and she felt a little bit of a background character.
Yes, and Briggs also plays well off Marshall, doesn't he? He's sort of the alpha male character, isn't he, of the archaeologist team.
Characters what could be sort of stereotypes, you know, masculine soldiers, and I think they work well when they're tampered by Briggs, who sort of puts him into his place, really.
Yes, it's a very very good example of assertiveness from Briggs, I think, throughout the book, in sort of dealing with Marshall and dealing with the situation. I think she rarely gets flustered. She tends to think things through, you know, instead of possibly we'd have male captains in Doctor Who stories who would go and rush headlong into situations, wouldn't they?
Right till the end, she sort of thinks and calculates and doesn't let her sort of soldiers or men get killed just for the sake of it.
Also impressed with, she got a bit more to do in this book. I thought Tegan had a little bit more to do in this book.
Oh, most definitely. I think, you know, she goes around this, you know, gets very angry, puts that anger into a good place by destroying sort of Cybermen and sort of, you know, being in control and being more action, I'd say.
Yes, and then we look towards the end then, isn't it? And it's such a horrific moment. Shall we begin to discuss it, Al, the ending? And say spoiler,
so
folks.
The ending, even read by Peter Davison, is pretty horrific when we, spoiler, get, you know, Adric's death.
That's it, the big spoiler, yes. Probably the first regular companion to die, I know Katerina had briefly joined the ship in the William Hartnell era, and she got sucked out into space during the Daleks' master plan in the Hartnell era. It's still quite a shocking and very well acted scene on television, and even further elaborated in the book, isn't it? We get the whole symbolism again of the gold maths badge, which is vital towards the ending, which was seen with a silent still camera shot in the TV version. You know, that's well described by Marta. The absolute shock of the Doctor, Tegan and Nyssa witnessing on the TARDIS viewer screen the freighter exploding, crashing into Earth.
Yeah, I think it's really well done in the book. It has that same sort of feeling. I think it sort of was, apparently I wasn't born there, but I think it was quite hard hit for people who watched it. You know, I think it still gets talked about to this day. That's ending with nothing, you know, no music or just, you know, Adric dying. I think it has affected people still to this day.
Yeah, I mean, I've gone a few years now between watching or reading this story, and I have recently started to rewatch all of the first Peter Davison series. I reached this point in Earthshock, and by this point I was finding Adric quite annoying, but Matthew Waterhouse really does, I think he raises his game acting-wise in the television version, and that heroism of Adric is very well written by Marta.
Oh, most definitely. I'm like, you are. I don't think... Do you actually enjoy Adric? Because I find him to be a bit annoying sometimes, but definitely by this one he picks up his game, you actually do feel sort of sorry for him going, really.
Yes, I think in the earlier stories he's put there to challenge the Doctor slightly.
Really? Because I was trying to work out earlier, because he only has like... How long has he been? He's only for about 3 years, isn't he?
I think maybe only 1.5 series, Al. He comes in...
Only 1.5 series, so it feels like longer. So I was trying to work that out yesterday.
At the beginning of the E-Space trilogy.
Yeah.
And, yes, that's nicely brought back round to in this story, isn't it? Because he's worked out a way to get back into E-Space, which is a great risk to the TARDIS, you know, and the Doctor reluctantly allows him to do this once they sort of kissed and made up later on, doesn't he? I mean, do you feel that worked in the book? Do you feel it was more tragic in that they had made up? Or would there have been added drama if they'd gone away on a bad note, if they had argued just before Adric had his ultimate fate?
I think it actually works in the book, because you have that sort of all that frustration at the beginning, and then they're still not getting on. Then they have that very edgy conversation where they make up, and the whole Adric showing his calculations, and then the Doctor saying, well, you didn't want to go back, and then saying how long it must have taken. So I think it works better knowing that, you know, the Doctor does miss him, basically.
Adding all the more to the tragedy towards the end.
Tragedy, you know, continues with the characters and the sort of big finish rate. It does get mentioned, the whole Adric thing, so it goes on affecting them, I think.
Yeah, I just noticed a few things from reading a few reviews online, Al. Plot holes in this story, I don't know how you felt about them. The use of a transponder for a signal is quite central to the story, and people have speculated as to why this didn't have a switch which could be turned off, perhaps by the vaporising weapons which are used elsewhere in the story. You know, how that was allowed to go on. What do you feel about a hole such as that?
Well, it isn't a niggle. Well, I don't think the story would have been as good as you if you could turn them off.
Yeah, it would have been over a lot sooner, wouldn't it, really?
Yeah, it's sort of those one things like, why don't you have a sonic screwdriver in every episode thing, isn't it?
Yes, and I think it comes across a little bit better in the book. I'm not sure if Marta has elaborated upon this. We saw in the most recent series, Peter Capaldi's Doctor was able to go to Clara at the moment of her death and actually extract her from time. You know, I don't know if Davison's Doctor, he tries to. I think it comes across better in the book. Perhaps Marta has added this. He finds there's something up with the console, doesn't he? And he can't actually go and try and rescue the fated Adric at this point.
Yeah, I think that works well in the book. I agree. You know, it's something, you know, you'd like to do, but don't, because it would change things, I suppose.
Stephen Moffat looked at that and thought the amount of effort the Doctor would have to go to rescue a deceased companion. If you look at, was it Heaven Sent, where he spent how many billion years picking through a wall to get to Gallifrey, and then he ends up having to shoot the Lord President and use all the power of an extraction chamber. So at least Stephen Moffat thought that one through and realised the Doctor would take a hell of a lot of effort to alter events in history such as that.
Oh, most definitely, definitely. And you can see what Moffat gave up quite a good bit of thought. It's a good episode, that is. But I think, you know, I can see that why they didn't do it with Adric at the time. It's probably didn't think of it at the time. But I think it works well now, people like Clara and that. Well, I think it's a completely unusual thing to have a companion die, because I don't think we've had one since. Well, as you say, no, we have had, haven't we, with the Ponds, they died, but I think that's the best one since.
But it hasn't been a sort of a horrific death in terms of a crash, is it?
You know, no, it was like, well, don't know. Well, I found that episode quite horrific when they...
It was very emotional, visceral, but you at least knew they went back and they lived in the 1930s, whereas Adric hit the planet and presumably got splattered into a million pieces.
Yeah, it is a bit more horrific, that sort of death. I don't know why. I think it worked. I think it made a good point at the time, and that you can't always win.
So do you think that would work in the new era, or do you feel there's a little bit of fear about perhaps ultimately killing off Clara or one of the more recent companions? Because there were rumours, weren't they, when Billy Piper leaving was leaked a decade ago, there were rumours, oh, Rose is going to die. And
I think it's this whole problem. We're a bit squeamish about death in England. We're a bit, we can't have it shown in a drama and it has to be a happy ending. Because I can remember with the Danny Pink character and that whole, we knew he was dead in a different world and they showed people being cremated and he felt it. There was so many complaints about it. So I just don't think they feel it's right, so like Doctor Who, to have a death. And I think it works, though.
Or if you look at another series which can tease the return of deceased characters, such as Sherlock did recently. Ultimately, it was all set in flashback. Sorry, spoiler for Mr. Moriarty, wasn't it? So,
Oh, yes. That was an interesting episode. Which sort of didn't work, in my opinion. What it was still good. Anyway, we might not see what we're all about there.
Welcome to the Sherlock Target Files, folks.
The Sherlock one, which we probably won't get for 2020 now.
This is Alex Gibbons' Doctor Who News Round.
Hello there, this is Who's News, Alex Gibbons, and it's the 27th of January, nearly the end of January. Right, first thing we need to mention are there are several one-day convention events coming up at Cardiff University. We have Saturday the 25th of February, Russell T. Davis doing a talk called Who's Queer Now? With Bethany Black and Gareth David Lloyd. The other event that is happening is a one-day event related to the 10th anniversary of Sarah Jane Smith. It's at Cardiff University again on the Saturday the 29th of July. On the same theme of the Cardiff University, Season 10 of Doctor Who have been filming there again, making Cardiff University look like part of Bristol University. Obviously something major is going to happen there in Series 10. Another part of Cardiff where filming has been seen is down in Cardiff Bay. Not too sure what's going to happen, but it's probably related to the same episode. The main major thing this week from BigFinish.com is the new 4-disc box set from Graceless, Season 4 of Graceless. If you're not too sure what this is a spin-off from their main Doctor Who range, where two people have been created by the Grace. The Grace are connected to the Black and White Guardian and have been used before in several of the Big Finish monthly Doctor Who main range involving Peter Davison. Big Finish have also released this week Torchwood One Rule, a lovely new box set with Tracy Ann Oberman back as Yvonne and also Gareth David Lloyd as Ianto. It's all taking place before the Battle of Canary Wharf.
So, talking about the covers, Al, the book first published in 1982, reprinted in paperback in 1983, and with a different cover in 1992. Controversially, one of the first books to start using photographs rather than cover art. Just a picture of Peter Davison squatting, really, with a gun sticking out. Not the most creative.
Not the greatest, is it?
Don't think I can rate that one too highly, or any with a picture on, really.
No, not really me either. It doesn't really say a lot, to be honest.
All credit to the photographer, I suppose, or the person who made the telly snaps out of this. But we do have, thankfully, hang on just a moment, Al. A Alistair Pearson cover from the reprint, which was also used, a variant of it was also used on the BBC audiobook, on the audiobook release, which we'll speak about in a minute. Yes, it's Earthshock with the old black ribbon, the Sylvester McCoy logo, as they had in the early 90s reprints.
Oh, yeah.
A very blue shot of space background. The Doctor one side of a Cyberman in the middle, Adric on the other side, looking above Earth, Ian Marta's name in red writing. Yeah, I think it works quite well. The Silver Cyberman plays well off the blue. The blue of the Doctor.
That sounds a lot better than the first one.
Yes, you know, I think it wins hand, any sort of effort with artwork wins hands down, really, in this one. So definitely the best there, folks. Perhaps I'm surprised it's only been reprinted once, this book, as it probably is one of the more popular ones. So perhaps we could have seen some more variants on the cover.
Interesting one, that one.
Yeah, so perhaps we could have seen more variants on the cover, but yeah, Alistair's done a very fine job again on that one.
Oh, definitely, whatever he does is good normally.
Okay, speaking about the audiobook release, read by the Fifth Doctor, Peter Davison, with Nicholas Briggs providing voices of the Cybermen. Your thoughts on the performance of Peter and the soundscape and the performance of Nick Briggs, Al?
Peter Davison reads it well. He doesn't occasionally have much change of his own voice. It was only a niggle I had about it, but otherwise I thought it was really good. He's obviously got Tegan done quite well because of, you know, working with Janet, so he knows her voice quite well. Adric and Nyssa were quite good as well. Soundscape-wise, I thought it was very good. You had good effects. You had battle scenes in the late of the book. Nick Briggs was very good as a Cyberman, like he always is. Perhaps a little bit sing-songy Cyberman, not the right period Cyberman in some points. But otherwise, I enjoyed it.
I've only just noticed really what you said about the sing-songy Cyberman. I'm going to praise Nick as well. I thought he got the balance right. I think we reviewed Tomb of the Cybermen recently, and I was a little, if you remember, I said I was a little disappointed in that, that he tended just to use the newer series Delete Cyberman voices.
Yeah, he seems to have toned it down a bit for the older ones in this, definitely. But I didn't know if he got the actual, you know, Cyber Commander's voice, exactly. I remember it being quite deep in the TV version.
Excellent.
Yes, David Banks, of course. I thought he did pretty well maintaining the balance. I think there was some suggestion I'd read online that Nick wanted to go for the full-on effect of the Earthshock Cybermen voices, but I think he manages the balance in between these two. I thought Peter Davison's performance was excellent in this book. Yeah, he really gave a lot of different tone to the characters, stating all their importance in the story. A lot of them had their moments, even if it was the ones who got a relatively quick death at the hands of the Cybermen's androids.
Every character has its place for it in the audiobook, and I thought it was well read, definitely, by Peter Davison.
Yes, indeed, and one of the very best things about it, I think, is the soundscape, Al. They managed to put you within the feel of the TV soundtrack, which has a lot of synthesizer work, a lot of dramatic beats, and I think they sort of blend that in. You had wonderful little moments like the dripping liquid in the cave, and you got the echoes out of that.
Oh, most definitely. I think it has a really good soundscape on this audiobook. You know, it did feel like you actually were in TV episodes, but sometimes, because it's a better book, I think, than the TV episodes. It felt really good, the sound effects. I think it did add to it.
One of the strongest Cybermen stories, to be honest. Excellent performance by Davison, and Nick Briggs brings a lot to the table in this one.
Oh, most definitely. I think, like you, it is one of the more stronger classic Cybermen stories, you know, because sometimes can be a bit weak, some of the old ones. I think this one's really good, to be honest.
Overall thoughts, Al. Your overall thoughts on Earthshock, the Target novelisation, the BBC audiobook.
Well, I really enjoyed it. I thought it had good pace, it had good sort of keeping you alive, and, you know, the story was well set out. It had good bits at the beginning, what basically built the pace up, and then we have that well, it's not a very nice thing, but a terrific ending to it where you feel extremely sorry for the main characters and wonder how they're going to cope without Adric at the end. So the book was very well written. I think Ian Marta does a really good job with his stories. Audiobook wise, I think Peter Davison read it fantastically. He knows all the characters, he knows who to give better, you know, intonation to, and Nick Briggs was brilliant as a sideman. So I think probably give the book an 8 and maybe the audiobook a 9.
Happy to say I really love this book. Added a lot to the TV series, which was always an excellent story, not just for the shock value of the end. Going to repeat a lot of what you said, Al. Very well paced, like a runaway train at times, but it sort of takes you in, keeps you really interested throughout. As you said, Ian Marta, fantastically visceral writer again, really gets to the side of the human parts of the characters in terms of their interactions and the situations they find them in, the fear, the emotion, the horror towards the end. Audiobook-wise, Peter Davison, excellent. Nick Briggs, excellent. The soundscape, excellent. Al, I'm going to go for 10 for both because I thought this was one of the very best we've listened to.
I think I was just being a bit conservative sometimes on the audiobook, but I think it does deserve a 10.
First Davison season, some of the stories which I love, sort of like The Visitation, Fort of Doomsday, Cash Revolver, can be a little bit drawn out. But this, as I just said, was a bit of a runaway train, wasn't it?
Most definitely. I just wonder, in the way they filmed episodes, which way did they film? I know they didn't start with Cast of Elba, did they?
Fort of Doomsday first one Peter Davison filmed back in 81. Something that Stephen Moffat repeated with Matt Smith. He filmed the Weeping Angels two-parter as Matt's first film story, with the 11th hour being the broadcast one, of course, which was filmed sometime later.
Yeah, brilliant.
Great men are forged in fire. It is the privilege of lesser men to light the flame.
Hello there. This is a slightly sad extra bit for the Target Files podcast due to the announcement today of John Hurt's death at the age of 77. What are your thoughts on it, Mike?
Well, pretty devastating again for Doctor Who fans. Fans of all his work, really, down the years. I can remember, not when they were originally broadcast, but the likes of I, Claudius, The Elephant Man, The Naked Civil Servant, 1984, and then for One Night Only back in 2013... the 50th anniversary, he wove his magic into Doctor Who and really set his stamp on an incarnation that we didn't know about previously. And I thought he fitted in like a glove.
Yeah, you just, for like one episode, you just had him there and he just fitted so well. Whatever he did in the past, you know, from his like Watership Down or V for Vendetta, it was just felt like it made the film better. That fact that he's an actor who could choose parts that would change things. You know, you look at the Naked Civil Servant, you know, and you look at The Elephant Man, people's opinions of, you know, gay and disabled people change because of his roles.
Excellent point, Al. Unfortunately, I never got to meet him. I don't think you did either.
No, unfortunately not. I wanted to, but there was no chance, unfortunately.
But the feedback from fellow Doctor Who fans who met him was incredible. Such an apparently humble, down-to-earth man, you know, nothing sort of starry about him. Perhaps we're losing a bit of that from modern British actors, Al, you know, going back to that period, sort of John Hurt, Tom Baker, Brian Blessed, Derek Jacobi.
Yeah, I would agree. They all seem to be, you know, don't have this concept of stardom like we have today. They just see it as doing a play or doing a role, you know, as he said in one of his interviews recently. He said, you know, I don't see it as work, it's a play. I hate people come out and say, oh, we really enjoy your work.
Moving on again to the Day of the Doctor, when the War Doctor first appeared and then went on to have some big Finnish stories. Yeah, I thought he blended it so well. He managed to evoke memories of a sort of older, sterner Doctor from the classic series, but also showed the pain of Eccleston's Doctor after he'd been through the war.
Oh, I think he did indeed. It was that whole not being a, you know, really bouncy or, you know, bright Doctor like we have with the other two in the, you know, the 50th anniversary, but as somebody who had all that pain of seeing war and crime and that, just the way he got, you know, everything into that one syllable, no more, you know, just think where he could do sort of really important things very quietly and it made you feel for the words, really.
Yes, an incredible talent. He apparently was cast very late in the 50th anniversary. I know Stephen Moffat had approached and spoken to Christopher Eccleston to come back as the sort of Ninth Doctor to incorporate him as the one who was there at the end of the Time War. May have been only a week or two, a few days before John Hurt was confirmed for the part. I believe he was abroad, perhaps in America or Canada at the time. Sort of flew back and, as we've said, fitted in like a glove. I do remember David Tennant and Matt Smith being interviewed around the publicity for the 50th anniversary. They felt they were literally in the presence of greatness, you know. They could speak at the end of the day about how much emphasis they'd put into a certain line, a certain part of the script. And then Matt sort of funnily says, and then you just look at John Hurt and he's able to convey all that with one look. You know, it's something. It's just a supreme talent he had crafted over a magical career.
Most definitely. He, you know, the way he could just say a sentence would fill the room. But he was a really down-to-earth person, apparently. Like people have been saying with the big finished recordings of The War Doctor, he would make sure he talked to every actor that, you know, he wasn't like stardom, like some actors would be like, you know, don't come near me, I'm the big star. It was like, you know, he'd just be part of the sort of troupe, the ensemble troupe we'd have with Big Finish, and that's why he was fantastic, I think.
Yeah, Saturday the 28th, as we record this, the news announced of his passing this morning. Edward Russell, the brand manager of Doctor Who, tweeted that a few of the Doctors went to Buckingham Palace around the 50th anniversary, and John was actually humble enough to ask Stephen Moffat whether he could refer to himself as a proper Doctor. And Stephen Moffat immediately said, look, without question, John, you know, you are going to be a star because of this episode within the Doctor Who fandom, as if you're not enough of a star already. Yeah, he cemented his place just so well in that wonderful anniversary story.
Oh, most definitely. He is part of the Doctor Who world now. And, you know, those, what have we got now? One, two, three, four War Doctor boxes. Everyone is so brilliant because of him. And there's just like, in each episode of the War Doctor boxes, it's like one, there's like scenes which are just like him and a character. And they're just brilliant. And they're only like 2-3 minute scenes. But that's what he could do. And it's like, when you had other things with him in, like, Merlin, where he was just like a voice of a dragon, he could lift CGI to a real personality.
Yes, absolutely. And the wonderful series in the 80s, The Storyteller, Jim Henson. You know, he was able to act off sort of puppeteers at the time, wasn't he? Able to embody a relationship with those characters as well.
Oh, most definitely. And other animations, you think, like Watership Down, where it's like an animation, because of the way his character was, you know, he could just pull it together. And I think this is what's going to be very interesting, because Big Finish are meant to be releasing his version of the Invisible Man this month, and it will be interesting to see how that goes now.
Yeah, I think we can almost expect it to be excellent, really. Yeah, multi-talented actor, probably one of the greatest this country has ever produced, to be honest, Al.
I think so. I think he's up there with people like Michael Caine and the Redgraves and that. He was, but it's just the humble beginnings, because he didn't have a big starry family like, you know, the Redgraves or the McGanns, and he just sort of fits into everything. And, you know, the fact that his roles were things he thought he shouldn't do, and he did them, like, you know, Naked Civil Servant and the Elephant Man, and you know, the major part of sci-fi history, him being the part of the alien and alien. Everything he did was brilliant, really, I personally think.
Yes, absolutely, and the greatest legacy for him, folks, is his work. And if you haven't seen sort of highlights we've already mentioned, such as The Naked Civil Servant, in which he plays Quentin Crisp, Alien, the first Alien film, he has a pivotal key moment in that, The Elephant Man, 1984, George Orwell, that's very prevalent in the world of modern politics. It's actually had a spike in sales on Amazon lately, but I recommend tracking down the film, which was made in the title year of 1984, starring John Hurt and Richard Burton. And of course he sort of topped off the career for me with that wonderful performance of The War Doctor, so thank you, John Hurt, and please go and check out some of his work if you haven't checked out enough of it yet, folks.
Most definitely, I totally agree with that. And you know, if you just go anywhere like Amazon, you'll see there are hundreds of films. Because I know when David Richardson was doing the War Doctor box sets, he's tried to get everything, and he said it would basically bankrupted him. So there are lots of things you can see him, and he did lots of TV, he did lots of films, and they're all brilliant. You know, just if you want something mainstream, you can pick the Harry Potter films. If you want something a bit abstract, you can pick The Elephant Man or V for Vendetta. He was a sort of actor who you could just put in anything, and even if he's only in it for, say, 3-5 minutes, he was brilliant. So go out there, look at his work, and enjoy it, basically.
And you said there was four. Are there four box sets of The War Doctor?
There are. There are four box sets. Three were out, and one was going to be out pretty soon.
Is that another War Doctor one as well as The Invisible Man, is it?
Yes. There's four War Doctor box sets. One was coming out soon, and The Invisible Man, Big Finish Classics, is out end of this month, I think, or in February, I think.
Yeah, so there we go. Thanks, folks. Rest in peace. A man who definitely became the Doctor in the 50th anniversary. Rest in peace, John Hurt.
Most definitely. Next time on the Target Files, we will be discussing The Horror of Fang Rock by Terence Dix. That's the book, and audiobook read by Louise Jameson.
Doctor Who Target Files Earthshock Review featured Alexander Gibbons and Michael Williams. Earthshock incidental music originally composed by Malcolm Clark. Newsround opening and closing themes originally composed by John Baker and by Ted Heath and his orchestra. I Am the Doctor, originally composed by Murray Gold. Version for this podcast by Grueling Terror 42. No copyright infringement intended on any of the music used in this podcast. Doctor Who Target Files Earthshock Review was recorded in Swansea, South Wales and Exeter, Devon, England during January 2017.